All right, a while back, and just I want to preface what I'm about, the question I'm going to ask. I know it's not going to sit well with a lot of us because you're like, how could that be? But it'll help us. So don't ask me anything about the question until we get to where we need to talk about it, okay? But I read an article a while back by a psychologist entitled, "Does Familiarity Breed Liking or Contempt?" And this article is based on three studies that were done to determine whether the more we get to know people, do we end up liking them more or liking them less? And it was fascinating because you would think that the more you get to know somebody, the more you will like them, right? But the studies found that the opposite is true. Familiarity breeds contempt is what it was basically saying. And I don't know what this says about our families or marriages. But know this, the more we get to know somebody, the more we find out things we don't like, and the more we don't like them, the less attractive they become. But again, quick take on this. The problem with scientific studies that deal with human behavior is that because we are so complex, you will always find a study that matches the outcome that it seeks to prove, okay? So just know that. And I read some of the opposite findings as well. But what intrigued me about this idea is it made me wonder something. Could this be true of our relationship with Jesus? Now, again, that doesn't sound right, but wait. And we'll get into it more. Because the more we get to know him, the less we will like him. Does familiarity with Jesus really breed contempt? Well, let's find out. We're going to look at Mark 6, 1 through 6. And I was planning on skipping this, to be honest with you, because I'm just like, all right, there's not a lot here. And, you know, all it is he returns to his hometown and he's rejected by those closest to him. So yeah, great info, but not a lot to go off of on that until I read this article and it got me thinking. So let's read Mark 6, 1 through 6. He went away from there and he came to his hometown and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue and many who heard him were astonished. Now remember, Mark's classic. He begins to teach, but he doesn't say what he taught, right? And because he's the action gospel, right? So there are, when he does record what Jesus teaches, then it's a big deal, but he doesn't record what is being what Jesus taught here. But the focus is on the response, okay? So notice this. Where did this man, well, they were all astonished. Where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us? Okay, so right now, can we just stop with the false notion of the perpetual virginity of Mary? Right here, right? I'm being serious that he has brothers and sisters, okay, which means she had sex. So let's stop with that. That's a false teaching. It's to elevate her, but it's deceptive. I just want to throw that out there. All right. Verse 4. And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his relatives, and in his own household. And he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he, Jesus, marveled because of their unbelief. And he went out among the villages teaching." All right, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. All right, now, what's interesting is I couldn't just pass over this because this teaches a major tenet of Christianity, and that is the humanity of Jesus. Now, most heresies in the early church were all centered around Christology, our understanding of who Jesus is. And the question that the early church raised was, how could Jesus be God and human? The pendulum, it swings either towards emphasizing his deity, or it swings the other way and emphasizes his humanity, all at the cost of the other. This is why in 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea was formed. It came to a consensus of what the church believed about the Son of God. And in a nutshell, the council affirms Jesus is fully God and fully man. His natures are not mixed. They're not confused. He was begotten, not made. So he's true God and true man, which is of the same substance or essence with the Father while being distinct. So the Nicaea Council came up with the fact that he is one God, perfectly distinct in three persons, but one God. So, all right, why this? Because just like in church history, Jesus's humanity has always been a stumbling block to people. Always. And what makes this text so shocking is he's a scandal to those who know him best. The people in his small hometown of Nazareth, his friends and neighbors, the people he grew up with, the people who he spent the most time with are the ones who reject him when he returns. Look at verse 1, because a change of location is a change in the tenor of this narrative. What did he just do in the Sea of Galilee area, right? In the previous chapter, he healed many people, he cast out demons. He heals a woman of her mastic, which we looked at last week, and he raises a girl from the dead. So his following is growing. He's gaining more and more attention and fame. But when he leaves Capernaum and travels 20 miles southwest to Nazareth, his ministry hits a snag here. Look at verse 5. And he could do no mighty work there. What happened in Nazareth? Well, I mean, think of it. Nazareth, it's a typical small town. Everybody knows everybody, right? It's hard to get away with anything in a small town, isn't it? Because everybody's going to know about it, right? Whose kids got into trouble on Friday night? Everybody knows. Who skipped school? Everybody knows. Who got pregnant? Who was at the hookah bar, right? Or hookah bar. What is it? Hookah. Yeah, the hookah bar smoking opium, right? Who knows everything because in a small town, you're known. Every Sabbath, they go to the same synagogue, right? Most people stay, they settle in where they grew up in a small town, except for those rebellious few, right, that want more, and so they will go to the big city looking for something bigger and better. And everybody in that town worries about whoever leaves. But here's what I just want you to notice. In chapter 3, verse 21, remember back then, Jesus's family went to Capernaum because they kept hearing reports about him. But why did they go to Capernaum? They went to try to restrain Jesus. They wanted to control him. They wanted to bring him back because they thought he'd lost his mind and he belongs in a psych ward. Well, in chapter 6, when he comes home, the reports about him preceded his coming. The whole town is talking about him. They show up in the synagogue on the Sabbath to hear him teach. And look at verse 2. Notice their reaction. Many who heard him were astonished. And they began to say, where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? Where did he get it? How are such mighty works done by his hands? They can't believe the things. Why? Because they know him. But notice, they do not refer to Jesus by name here. Instead, with suspicion and distance, they say, this man. You didn't go to rabbinical school, so where did you get this wisdom and knowledge? You have no formal biblical training, so where did this come from? They're absolutely blown away by his teaching, his wisdom, his miracles, but notice, they're not blown away by his person. Does familiarity with Jesus breed contempt? Now, so far in Mark's gospel, every time Jesus teaches, the crowds are amazed at his teaching, right? But notice, what do the crowds say? He teaches as one who has authority. He teaches as the author of the scriptures, the one who's the author of their lives. He teaches in such a way that his teaching is not like the religious leaders' teaching. And here it's no different, right? The people of Nazareth, they're amazed by his wisdom. They're amazed at the authority of his teaching. But notice, they can't accept it because they know him. Now, we don't know what he taught, but in Luke chapter 4, there's a very similar scene in verses 17 to 21 where Jesus in the synagogue is expounding on Isaiah 61. So maybe this is what he was teaching. And the scroll, the prophet Isaiah, was given to him. He unrolled the scroll. He found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, he gave it back to the attendant and sat down, and the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him, and he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Now, we don't know for sure, but gosh, could you imagine if he's proclaiming this incredible good news of the Lord's favor, that he's the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy, wouldn't you expect the people in this small town to rejoice then? That the liberator of their captivity is here? Maybe if these people didn't know Jesus, though. Maybe if they didn't know him, then maybe they would rejoice. Maybe they would believe. But notice, it's because they know him that in verse 3, they took offense at him. And the word offense here means scandalon. So Jesus is scandalous to them. They stumble over him. They're offended by him. They're put off by him. They're repelled by him. And in the first part of verse 3, we see why. Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? Jesus, we know who you are. We know who your family is. You did not receive any biblical training. You're merely a carpenter. You're a nobody. You're the son of Mary. And don't miss this. It's not a compliment because this is a patriarchal society. You're the son of the father, not the son of the mother. Nobody would ever speak that way. So maybe Joseph has already died. We don't know. But if you know the story and what happens in John 8, you know that his reputation followed him wherever he went. And what was that reputation? You're a bastard. Right? Who's your dad? We don't know, right? Because if Mary was a virgin and she becomes pregnant, the scandal of his birth followed him. And I think that's what they're intending here. Yeah, yeah, you're the son of Mary, because we don't know who your daddy is. Welcome home, Jesus. Good to have you back. Right? Not a very pleasant homecoming, is it? The offense and rejection of his hometown, it leads Jesus to respond with a proverb in verse 4, that a prophet is honorable everywhere but at home. And one commentator said this, he takes a piece of wisdom current in his day, this proverb, and he applies it to three concentric social circles in Nazareth, his hometown, his relatives, and then his own house. Each of the circles becomes more restricted, more personal, and more painful, doesn't it? It gets deeper and deeper and goes more personal inside these three circles. Starts out there, yeah, it's one thing for the townspeople. Yeah, it's another for Uncle Bill and Aunt Sue to reject me. But your brothers and sisters in your own home? So what's interesting about Jesus' immediate family is that those closest to him, they don't believe in him. And in John 7, Jesus' own brothers did not believe in him. I mean, in fact, James doesn't believe in him, who becomes one of the apostles, right? He doesn't believe in him until later on. So maybe there was sibling rivalry going on. We don't know. I mean, holy cow, how many times did his siblings hear, hey, why can't you be more like Jesus? Right?
Just one question.
Yes.
Probably wouldn't have been a part of that. I know
right.
She's a sinner,
right.
She knew who it was, right?
Yeah. Yep. But could you imagine being related to somebody who was literally perfect? Probably not. With their understanding of what they thought the Messiah would be. I mean, yes, because he's going to set the captives free, but for them, they're thinking captivity under Rome, right? Right. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying, familiarity. He's been around them. They do know him. They have seen him, but do they know his character?
So, I think I heard somewhere that when Jesus did that quote from Isaiah, that he left out a couple of phrases or verses. And I don't know if you're going there, but the ones that he left out were about judgment.
Coming, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but here's the thing. There's no mention of any of his brothers or sisters coming to faith. Which, wouldn't that be a pretty strong argument against Christianity? By skeptics? I mean, even his own family did not believe in him, so why should we? The reason why, here it is, and this is why I want y'all to wait. The reason why we should believe in Jesus is the reason why the people he grew up with reject him. Those closest to him reject him because he's too much like them. Jesus's humanity, in other words, his normalness, his closeness, The fact that he's a regular guy is the reason they are offended and reject him. There's nothing spectacular about him. Okay, can I say that again? There's nothing spectacular about him. Why are we obsessed with Christian leaders? Why are we obsessed with those who are popular? Why are we obsessed with them? Because they're popular. That's not Jesus' character at all. Again, we love famous. And we hop on the bandwagons. Notice, though, they don't deny his authority of his teaching. They're amazed by it. They don't deny his wisdom. They just don't know where it comes from. They don't deny the mighty works. They just can't believe that this carpenter, this son of Mary, is capable of doing these things. So instead of seeing the authority and the wisdom of his teaching, instead of seeing the mighty works of his hands as being the evidence that he is the Messiah, they only see a carpenter who, in their minds, was born out of sexual immorality. So they're offended and they're repulsed by him. And because of their unbelief and rejection, verse 5 tells us he could do no mighty work there. It isn't because he's unable to do mighty works, because he does lay his hands on people and sick people and heals them. It's because their hearts are so hard towards him. If he did more, it would have hardened even more against him. Which leads to a scary statement in verse 6. This is what arrested me. Jesus marveled because of their unbelief. He marveled. Right? He marveled at the centurion's faith. And now he's marveling at the lack of faith he sees from people he grew up with. Really? You still don't believe me? Really? You still won't accept me? I came so near to you that I would actually enter your world and become like you. I came so close that I actually grew up and lived with you so that you could know me, and you still reject me. You still reject my love. You still reject my salvation. My closeness is still an offense to you. Is God becoming human an offense to you? Do you stumble over the fact that God wants to be so near you that he became like you? Is the fact that God would humble himself and stoop to our level in order to walk in our shoes, is this too good to be true or too offensive to believe? This is what separates Christianity from every religion in the world. This is what makes Christianity unique. Every other world religion sees salvation as an escape from this world, a release from the physical world, an escape from this world's realm to enter into some other ethereal spiritual realm where we will be freed from our humanity and enter some spiritual paradise in the clouds. And there are branches of Christianity that believe this, where the goal is to get out of the physical, right? Because the physical's bad. We got to get into the spiritual, because only the spiritual is good. The goal is to get out of this world and enter heaven. Do you realize that's the whole objective of the doctrine of the tribulation? And you got to understand this, people. Okay, again, I went to Dallas Theological Seminary, which is the seminary that teaches about the end times. Okay? And I had John Walvoord, founder in his 90s, I had him say this: the whole doctrine of the tribulation is because of the previous understanding that Israel and the church are separate. That's where it comes from. Because Israel will be on the earth in the millennial kingdom, where Jesus will reign and rule, and the church will be in heaven spiritually. That's not what we're seeing. And that's not what's going to happen. I'm sorry to burst your bubble if you believe that. But I think I need to say it, because right now a lot of us are like, are we? We are in the end times. World events that are happening. Every generation believed they are in the end times. They did. They did. I happen to believe we actually are. all right, anyway, so where was I going? Oh, yeah, here we go. No, yeah. According to the book of Revelation, the end is not heaven, is it? No, it's a new heaven and a new earth. The new Jerusalem coming down to live on a new physical earth. Where guess what? We're going to eat. We're going to drink. We're going to play. We're going to touch. We're going to hug. It's physical. There's going to be buildings. There's going to be houses. There's going to be plants. There's going to be animals. Hopefully Maximus, my first lab. Yes. See, in other words, in Christianity, salvation, it's not a release from the physical world that goes upward. It's a rescue for the physical world that comes downward. It's God coming down to rescue. God coming down to redeem. God coming down to restore and recreate the physical world to be what it should be. What God created it to be, without sin, without separation, without rebellion. Gosh, where we will be perfect. You imagine, like, one of the things, I think, I don't know if I told you all this, but I know my brother and I had this conversation. You know, when you think about it, the people you love the most are typically the people you hurt the most. Can you imagine? I'm going to love everybody perfectly. And I'm going to be loved by everybody perfectly. So when you think of our wars and our conflicts relationally here, keep that in mind. I'm not going to hurt my wife by my selfishness. I'm not going to hurt my children. I'm going to love them perfectly. And I'm going to love God perfectly. And I'm going to experience the reality of his perfect love. And that's the reason why. Man, so I'm going to be in perfect harmony with all of creation as well. Perfect worship and love for God and perfect love for one another. You know what we call that? Shalom. That's why this class is called Shalom. Everything's headed that way. That's where everything's going. Perfect relationship between God and all that he created. Man. So, what is so offensive to the people who know Jesus best should be what makes Jesus so spectacular and believable. that God wants to be so close with us that he actually becomes like us. He wants to be so near to you that he actually identifies with you and experiences everything you experience. I don't want you to miss the significance of verse 6. If Jesus became like us, then what effect did this rejection have on him? See, here's something we don't think about, or we normally don't tend to think about this. But if he is 100% God and 100% human, then he feels and experiences every emotion we do. We experience all kinds of emotions, don't we? But none of those emotions are not tainted because of sin. So imagine experiencing emotion perfectly without sin. That means he experiences the reality of that emotion on a level we never will. All of our emotional experiences are stained and distorted and tainted in some way by sin. I mean, I experience joy, but I don't experience it perfectly. I experience grief and disappointment, but not perfectly. So imagine what Jesus experiences emotionally as the perfect, sinless human being. See, we don't tend to think about that. We tend to think that because Jesus was perfect, he doesn't understand what we go through, right? But as the perfect human being, he actually understands more deeply what we go through, more profoundly and more powerfully than we do. This is why when the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 4, verse 15, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." And this is the thing. We think Jesus doesn't understand sin because he never committed it. Who do you think understands temptation better? See, what happens to the temptation when you give into it? It goes away. Because you gave into it. Can you imagine never giving into it? Who understands temptation better? When Jesus is rejected by those who know him best, he actually feels the rejection more deeply and profoundly than when we do. He is, the word is actually, it's extraordinarily amazed at their unbelief. The unbelief of those who know him best. But even more, golly, is this not a foreshadowing of another rejection? The real scandal of Christianity is not that his hometown relatives and family reject him. The real scandal of Christianity is that his own father rejects him. See, he identifies so closely with us that he takes upon himself not just all of our humanity, but he takes upon himself that which he's never known, our sin. On the cross, he becomes our sin, which means he became an offense to his Father. Jesus became the most sinful man to ever walk this earth. Can I say that again? Because you need to understand that. Jesus became the most sinful man on the earth. Why? Because every sin of all of his people was put on him. And can you imagine if you feel dirty and gross because of your sin, how he feels? When you experience shame, can you imagine what he feels? Do you think Jesus understands your fear of rejection? Not by those in your neighborhood, workplace, and family, but your greatest fear of being rejected by God. Man, God became human so he could be near us, so that we could know him, so that he could be familiar to us. And our familiarity with Jesus should not breed contempt. It should actually breed extraordinary amazement at his grace. Because which is more spectacular? A God who demands your perfect service and who will punish you for every failure, or a God who gives you his perfect service and punishes his son for your failure? A God who displays raw power and yet remains distant and abstract? Or a God who comes so near to identify with you that he actually takes everything that is bad about you and then gives to you everything that is good about him? Which is more spectacular, a God who makes you pay for your offense, or a God who becomes your offense so you could be accepted by him? Two things. Man, way early. Okay. I want you to understand this. Because Jesus is fully human, because he understands us and because he experiences everything that we experience, go to him with whatever you're faced with. So that's the thing. It's like why don't we? Because we think he doesn't understand. He understands everything you're going through. So go to him with whatever you're going through. Pour out your heart to him with whatever is in your heart. Good, bad, doubts. Again, that's what I love about the Psalms. Why? Because it's Israel's prayer book. Every emotion is covered in the Psalms. And that's why I love Psalm 42 and 43. Why are you downcast, oh my soul? Have you ever felt that way? Something's bothering you, but you can't pinpoint what it is. I told my wife last week, I said, I know I'm different because of my mom's death, but I don't specifically know how I'm different. I haven't pinpointed that yet. I just know I'm different. I know it's affected me in a way that I'm not the same person I was. He understands that. Go to him. Because again, what is it he wants? He wants your heart. Again, we can go back to quote scriptures. Yes, okay. Guess what? He doesn't want your sacrifice. He wants your heart. What's the sum of the law? Does anybody know? To love the Lord your God, mind, soul, and strength, and then what? They can't be separated. But did you catch the priority? Loving God is what leads to loving neighbor. It's an effect. It's the fruit. But it's all about love. So So take your problems, take your stress, take your anxieties. Please put my wife out of a job. No, don't, because we need the salary. Well, I mean, what did she say? It's just like, what is it? Counselors are what? They're friends. Take your worries, take your hurts, take your temptations, take your sin, take your pain. Take it to him. And God, he wants to be near you. Second, because God stooped to become like us, why do we need to be spectacular to others? Why can't we just be normal people? Why do we need a spotlight? Why do we try to elevate ourselves above other people? Because God stooped to become like you. Guess what? You're free to be normal, Dallasite. I'm sorry. We live in a type A culture with very successful people. And what's fascinating about Dallas as opposed to other places, a lot of it's self-made. You're free to be normal. Could you imagine what that would do to a high school? Parents, could you imagine what that would do to you raising teenagers? When you're so consumed about their resume, about what college they're going to get into, what job they're going to have, what specific sports they do or activities, you're free to be normal. Not everybody's going to be a Matthew Stafford, Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, or Clayton Kershaw. Although every parent thinks their child will. That's why they spend this exorbitant amount of money at a young age on coaches and whatever have you. Which means you don't have to be the prettiest. You don't have to be the smartest. You don't have to be the wealthiest. You don't have to be the best. He loves you for who you are. Period. Which means, and I'm going to say, all right, you're free to offend people. Not in a bad way, but in an incarnational way. Which means you're free to enter in and to relate to people who are different than you. You're free to bear one another's burdens and help people. You're free to give of yourself for the good of others instead of always trying to get from others. Jesus came down to become your offense. And he was rejected so you could be accepted. Go and live knowing this, because what would happen? You'd probably begin to display that to other people. 15 minutes early, y'all. And I actually had 10 pages of notes. I know if I have more than 7, I'm going to go long. And I have 10 pages. So we got through that quick. But I want to harp on that a little bit more, and let's just kind of talk about that. There was nothing what Isaiah tells us, right? There was nothing about him that would attract us to him. And here, there's nothing spectacular about him in the world standards. So the whole celebrity pastor stuff today, I'm sorry, it drives me up a wall. But what does it also prove? Nobody can handle it. I mean, in all honesty, I thought the type of church that God was going to raise up in Edmond, Oklahoma, would be PCPC. And I thought I had the personality to do it. And you know what he did? Oh, he humbled me greatly. He humbled me greatly. And you know what's also fascinating? And I love this. And I knew this would happen. The church grew under Clay, who took over after me. But that's so awesome to me now, that the student far excels the teacher. What a joy. He is. I talk to him every week. And yes, he's going through right now what I told him he would go through, but he's not going to understand what I'm saying until he goes through it. I said, the weekly burden, and it is a burden. You need to know that. The weekly burden of preaching weighs heavy, and it will affect you in ways that I can tell you, but you're not going to get it till you go through it. And he's going through it right now. And so, yeah, I can just testify to that. Because you're handling holy things, weighty things. And it does affect you. That's why, again, nobody understands what a preacher goes through. When you spend all week pouring yourself into the text, and then on Sunday morning you pour yourself out. That's why I say Sunday would always be my most sinful day, because I'm so empty. So again, you got to understand that. And Jesus understood it. So I know he gets me, even though you may not. You're free to be normal in a world of overachievers who want to make a name for themselves, in a city that's all about making a name for itself. You're free not. You're free to be a nobody. And that's why I remember Dr. Hannah saying this about people who we don't even know. He said, they will be the ones closest to Jesus, and I'll never meet them because I'm going to be way back there. Preach the gospel and be anonymous has become now my new logo. I'll make a t-shirt of it or get a tattoo of it someday. I don't know. But that's really it. All right, we got time, because we got to get out of here early. Remember, I got a book right afterwards. But any questions? Or just comments or whatever? A partial preterist? No, I'm full blown. Augustine convinced me that when Jesus returns, it's over. And then everything becomes new. There is not going to be this 1,000-year reign. We're not going to be raptured. Again, that whole passage in 2 Thessalonians, you got to know the historical context. Because what would happen when a king would return as the victor? The whole town would go out to meet him. And then you would have a triumphal procession back into the town. That's what he's saying when the last trumpet, whatever, we're going to be caught up to meet him. We're going to see our victor and the triumphal then entry. And that's it. And then it's everlasting life.
The last part of your lesson reminds me so strongly of Philippians 2.
2, yeah.
6 and 7.
Yep.
For being in the very nature of
God.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Of a servant.
And then look at the command in verse 3. Read the command in verse 3 of Philippians 2.
Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourself.
That just took the golden rule up a notch, did it not? I don't want you to just love others as you love yourself. What does he say? I want you to actually think other people are more important than you are. Who treats people that way? And then Paul goes on to say, have this mind among yourselves, because this was Jesus's mindset. And what was his mindset? He did not hold on to his greatness as God, but he let it go for your good. And became your servant, your slave. You know, that's the very character and nature of God, which means when he made us in his image, that's the image he wants us to display to others. I would say it this way, stop making yourself big. Do nothing out of rivalry or vain conceit, that's puffed up pride. Do nothing to seek to make yourself big. Yes. Exactly. Yeah, well, this is why our models of sanctification are so bad for Christians. Because it's Christ-likeness. Which means sanctification is when you decrease and Jesus increases. You know you're being sanctified. You know, so here's what I would say. How do I know the gospel is working? How do I know that the power of the gospel is at work in people's lives? Answer, when they start dealing honestly with their sin. That's how I know. Why? Because now they know they can because of the gospel. That means I'm free to face the reality of my selfishness, my inward bent towards self, to make myself big. I can deal honestly with that. That's my nature. And so, yes, there should be contrary to that. But in our Christian culture, who do we elevate? The celebrity. Those who have it all together. Those who look like they have it all together. Right? Those who do spectacular things for God. Normal. Normal. And that's why we continue then with that Philippians 2 passage. It's because Jesus was unspectacular that God makes him the most spectacular person in the universe. Exalts him above everything. Everything. So that's why when Jesus makes statements like, whoever wants to be great, notice, he tells you how to be great. Be the servant of all. You want to be great? In my kingdom, here's what it means. Notice, he's not bashing them for wanting to be great. He just tells them what true greatness is, right? In the same way, it's like, all right, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Notice he does not say, do not seek treasure, because he knows we will seek treasure. He just tells us, what's the true treasure that we should be seeking, right? It's just backwards. All right, let me pray. And we, whoop. Okay. Time's up. There we go. Yep. Gracious Heavenly Father, we do thank you that Jesus took on flesh and blood, that he became like us so he could stoop below us and serve us. And let that impact us. And then when it impacts us, may we be the kind of people who stoop below to serve others in order to lift them up. So create this in us. Make us like this, because we will be different than the world. And the world will take notice. And Jesus tells us that when the world takes notice, it will prove that we are your disciples. So help us. Help us, forgive us of our celebrity status and our obsession with being great. And help us to live normal lives. And I think the church would look different as well. And I pray that that actually happens. And I pray that you would do this for your glory and for our good. In Jesus' name, amen.